Thanks, Tim. Okay, so for the next 15 minutes or so, 15, 20 minutes, I want to provide an overview of research that I'm currently working on concerning community intervention, policy mobilities, and different forms of diversity management, or diversity management is what they call it, but it's not the same term I'd use. So the project concerns two US community intervention organisations. I'm going to talk a little bit about them today. So the first one is Cure Violence, and then the second one is Cure Prejudice, and that's the name that I'm using just for this presentation. Now, both of these community organisations are concerned with changing behaviour, with changing attitudes, and also changing social norms. And both of these two US community organisations have actually developed an international network of city branches across which their programmes are generally mobilised. Now, the project that I'm working on has two aims. So the first of these is to examine how these organisations actually mobilise community intervention programmes. So this is looking at how best practice and ideas are communicated, how learning takes place between different cities, and also how different local, national and international agendas for social change are actually established. And the second aim is to ask what role the urban plays in these networks. So these networks position the city as replication sites. So asking what impact these organisations have on the ground in different urban and cultural contexts. So also asking then how these international networks might facilitate leadership from the ground up. So you can see there from the slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about Cure Violence first, then Cure Prejudice, which is the one that I'm going to then focus on for the rest of the presentation. And Cure Prejudice is the one that I've just started research on just now. Okay, so first up then is Cure Violence. And Cure Violence, pictured here, was established in Chicago in 1995, and it was established to tackle gang-related violence in particular, and has since been replicated in other cities across the US. Now, following its initial success in reducing homicide, much of its work really revolves around what are called violence interrupters. Now, these interrupters are individuals, often former gang members, who monitor and dissipate community tensions and intervene in situations before they actually hit a tipping point, and that's how they describe it, or a point at which they might spill out into violence. Now, this poster here is for a documentary that was made on the people working in Chicago and follows them around the communities in which they work in as they deal with local tensions and conflicts. Now, despite the initial success of this program in Chicago, there were questions that were actually raised about its implementation in cities elsewhere. And this is because the results in other cities weren't necessarily as good as they were in Chicago. So as a result, there were questions asked about whether this was a problem with bad implementation and management, or whether it was actually the case that these cities had very different local contexts and problems, which were not necessarily suited to the programming and its kinds of methods of intervention. So in short, then, there was a significant gap between what was promised on the one hand, or expected, and what actually happened on the ground in some of these new replication sites. So alongside questions about effective implementation, there are some other concerns regarding the replication of violence reduction programmes more broadly. So this includes the difficulty of assessing public programmes that present themselves as relatively comprehensive when actually they're made up of multi-component efforts to tackle what are essentially a variety of very different social problems, which are normally loosely categorised as issues of violence and conflict. And this is also whilst trying to mobilise community more widely. So this is really thinking about how these programmes become linked into other local community networks, agendas, and perhaps other programmes, such that they no longer become reducible to the initial programme with which they were established. So what I'm interested in particular, and what hasn't been mentioned by some of these earlier studies, is actually how this form of community work is communicated and then learnt across a national and international network of replication sites. And replication, and I use this word because this is a word that is used a lot by both of the organisations that I'm looking at. So one of the things that struck me, particularly from watching this documentary when I first came across the group, is how do people in Chicago train people in Johannesburg to recognise and interpret local community tensions and tipping points when the context of the urban violence that they're dealing with is often very different? So just to give you an idea, then this is a map of the other replication sites outside of the US that the group is actually working with, or where they're currently working on establishing new partnerships. So you can see just from looking at the where the cases, where the cities are actually located, just how different the contexts are in which this community program has been mobilized. So bearing in mind that this community program started with gang violence in Chicago. Okay, so that's the first one, so that's Cure Violence. Oh, and this is one of the most recent additions to the organisation. This is Survive Our Streets. This was set up in London just last year following the urban riots that took place in the UK in 2011. And they've developed very close links with Chicago to try and think about how they might actually deal with community tensions, particularly around youth offenders in London. And as you can see here, they talk a lot about how violence is considered to be something that can be treatable, much like a disease. So it's seen as a health problem. Okay, so Cure Prejudice. And Cure Prejudice is the second group that I'm looking at, and is the one that I'm currently doing research on now. So this organisation was also established in the US, and this is established to tackle inter-ethnic conflict on college campuses in particular. And this is in the 1980s. Its main purpose was to provide leadership training for individuals in the local communities affected so that they might be better able to confront conflict, but also initiate conflict resolution programs and run workshops that would really address prejudice and tease out some of the roots of misunderstandings in what they describe as being a very safe space. Now, much like Cure Violence, following its success on college campuses, the organisation developed a leadership training programme which was then rolled out across other college campuses where the organisation was offered permanent residence in the form of on-site office spaces. Now, the organisation is now an international not-for-profit leadership training network that tackles discrimination much more broadly. So it started off with inter-ethnic conflict, but now does work on homophobia, sexism, racism, and has also started to do some work on violence and extremism as well. So having begun then with these college campuses, much of its work is now organised around the city, around city chapters they're called, in the US, in Canada, in the UK, in Europe, and it's just moved into Latin America. So it's a very big international organisation now. So as part of my research and that I've just started, I'm moving between some of the cities. So just to give you a brief idea of what I'm looking at, the top there, some of the main cities in its European organisation. So we've got Zurich, Basel, Bern and Vienna. And then in the UK, London, Bristol and Nottingham. And then in the US, we've got Annapolis, Chicago, New York, Seattle, Philadelphia, Austin and Missoula. Okay, so these are some of the cities that I'm going to be working in. Now, what has remained constant as this group has actually moved is this workshop that they've developed in order to tackle discrimination. And this workshop is normally a one-day leadership training workshop that is composed of a number of different exercises, and they're normally interactive exercises around storytelling sessions that are particularly designed to address and further unpack the workings of prejudice, but also give participants the chance to talk about their experiences of discrimination and provide a safe space for bringing together conflicting viewpoints and ideas. So the idea is that these workshops then actually empower people, once they've had the training, to go back to their communities or to go back to their city chapters and actually affect social change. So the workshop then is really one aspect that is really replicated across this large international network. So to give you an example, in 2 weeks' time I'm attending a five-day, it's called a Leadership Institute in the US, and this is described as replication training. So they have people that come from all over the international network who attend this training to actually teach people how to replicate the workshop model and then take it back to their communities wherever they might be. So really then what I want to stress here is that this workshop model and design is really strictly followed. So when you're being trained in the workshop design, we're told never to deviate from the order of exercises in the programme, that the exercises won't work if they're cherry-picked or if they're perhaps used in conjunction with other training programs. And so this emphasis on replication tells you something about how this particular model is closely monitored. So as part of my research then, I'll be undergoing training at each of these city branches to see how the replicated model actually takes place on the ground, so what it looks like in these different urban and cultural contexts. So really asking how different communities respond to what is essentially a very American program of leadership training. I'll also be attending their AGMs, their diversity workshops, which address issues in the local areas, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment, and visiting some of their outreach projects, talking with both facilitators and participants. So in terms of outreach in the US alone, this work includes working with schools, colleges, universities, social housing associations, youth offender programs, as well as doing diversity days in their local communities. So really, I just want to tease out some of the points now that I think have some interest to the wider set of debates that we'll be discussing for these 2 days. Because whilst on the one hand, I'm interested in how these city chapters are networked, so how the workshops are replicated and how ideas are communicated, so how this international organisation is structured and then monitored, my research is also asking what happens on the ground. So how do people respond and what effects does it actually have in different city contexts? So this is bringing it back to questions of lived experiences and focusing on the people that work to actually remake their cities and the local communities from below. So first of all, when looking at how these urban networks are assembled, I'm really interested in the biographies of the people that are involved. So particularly given that so many of the people involved in these two programs are volunteers, so they're not elites, they're not experts or public officials. So what I'm asking is what motivates them and what aspirations they actually have for their communities. So some have experienced prejudice, for example, and get involved for those reasons. Sometimes people get involved following particular events of violence or instances in the community. So I said there's a lot of outreach work after the urban riots in 2011, but also this group has been involved in work since the killing of Lee Rigby in Woolwich just recently to think about community tensions and how they might be addressed. And then there are also people that get involved because they're responsible for diversity issues in their workplaces or just have an interest in cultural diversity. And to some extent, this responds a little bit to what Tim was saying about method and policy mobilities, because one of my aims is to actually follow participants after having done the workshop to see where they take this particular programme. And often the idea is that people do the workshop, they learn the skills, and then they might actually be crucial to setting up another city branch of this organisation elsewhere. So actually following it as that actually happens. In asking about the biographies of the agents involved, I'm also interested in friendship networks. So whilst there's been plenty of work on the value of face-to-face contacts, international conferences, and informal interpersonal communication within policy mobilities work, little has been explicitly said about the role of friendships in mobilising ideas. So Cure Prejudice holds regular international and national AGMs and retreats where facilitators from across the network regularly meet up. They swap stories, experiences and advice, and also undergo further training to ensure that they're constantly keeping an eye on how the programme's being delivered. And so a lot of the facilitators develop friendships either between city chapters within their country or actually internationally. And so while this organisation is relatively dispersed, the city chapters actually develop a sense of community. And this provides a very different account of interurban relations, but also contributes, these friendships actually contribute to the constant assessment and the review of the delivery of the programme. So one of the first workshops that I did was facilitated by a UK and Chicago facilitator. And the Chicago facilitator had been brought into London by her friend to actually help him deliver the programme. And in that delivery, they were both assessing each other on how they're actually, you know, delivering the workshop and its exercises. And this particular form of network community is also solidified through an international website, so newsletters and emails that list the group's success stories. And then this keeps each city chapter up to date with its national and international partners, and also presents each success story as a success for the wider programme. So the mobilisation of success stories in this instance is both inside and outside of workshops actually further legitimises the programme along with the continuous listings of clients, testimonials and patrons. So to some extent, this is where some of the coherency of the programme actually begins to destabilise. and will be where the research will be looking at how the organisation is made up in different cities. So just to give you an idea, in the UK, patrons include MPs, judges, key religious figures and councillors, and then some of the clients that this company might work with includes schools, emergency services, the NHS, workplaces, private firms and councils. And all of these have actually brought in Cure Prejudice to undertake diversity training for a variety of different reasons. Now on top of this, as I mentioned, each city chapter holds more specific local events. So workshops on gang violence in Chicago, for example, Islamophobia in London, anti-Semitism in Vienna. So they're tailored to meet the needs of the local community. And this to some extent, brings different individuals together and also they also become linked into different local and national policies as well. So to give you an example, with the recent emphasis on intercultural dialogue and conflict resolution in Europe, by the EU and by the European Commission, this means that some of the Swiss branches have seen new opportunities opened up for funding and they can tap into different resources that their US counterparts can't actually tap into. So I'm interested in looking at how this actually changes the programmes in different city contexts. So thinking a little bit about methodological innovation and forms of urban ethnography, I just want to say something about my engagement with communication studies and cultural discourse analysis as a way of really looking at the effects of mobilising what is a very American programme internationally. Now, as Donald Carbo has argued, cultural discourse analysis can really put policy in its place by exposing some of those gaps between local communities and what takes place on the ground and an organisation's way of operating. And he outlines three things. So gaps in concepts, conduct, and cooperative action. So for example, even if we take some of Cure Prejudice's key terms, so conflict, violence, prejudice, and oppression, we can see that these have very different meanings and different resonances in these different cultural and urban contexts as they move around. Furthermore, if you look at the language that are used by these kinds of groups to communicate cultural and social norms by these programmes, so the reference to violence as a form of disease, and then the use of terms such as empowerment, self-fulfillment, emotional heartache, individual responsibility, and then the American dream as a shorthand for a group of very particular aspirations. All of these have American cultural frames of reference that don't necessarily always translate or work on the ground when they're taken elsewhere. So I'm asking really, how do these concepts, how are they taken up in these social projects in these different cities? And this isn't so much just about verbal communication. So these workshop exercises also, this replicated workshop, also demands physical contact as a part of it. So holding hands, pushing, supporting, hugging. And it also demands more performative ways of engaging with people. So shouting, singing, laughing and crying are all encouraged as a way of breaking down barriers between participants and really overcoming inhibitions. And then direct eye contact and the direct communication of negative messages is really part of the organisation's main agenda to really get people to talk about their prejudices, their anxieties and their experiences of discrimination. So with this project then I'm starting to think about how the cultural norms that underwrite many of the exercises which are built on confrontational approaches work or don't work in different contexts. Now whilst this might seem to some extent like a minor point picking apart some of these words, there are actually huge implications in terms of thinking about how policies or programmes fail in different locations. So whilst I was doing some of my early research on Cure Prejudice, a new city chapter had opened up in the UK and within a couple of months it actually collapsed fairly spectacularly and a lot of the blame was actually placed at the facilitator's door for this failure. Now, part of the problem was that the new facilitator felt that direct eye contact and communication was actually very disrespectful. But this wasn't necessarily understood by a lot of the participants who found that the facilitator's tendency to talk to the floor was actually rather disconcerting. So they then found it very, very difficult to engage with the facilitator with some of the exercises. So this lack of eye contact really developed a distance between the facilitator and between the participants. And therefore the exercises really failed to produce anything effective. and became a source of frustration, if you like, for the participants, and then actually became a source of complaint. So, if you like, there was a really sort of sad, tragic disconnection between the facilitator's desire to effect social change and learning in the city and what actually happened on the ground. And a lot of this was due to the religious demographic of the city and the workshops involved. So, for example, the workshops that take place in Bristol and London, the demographics of the groups are always very, very different. And so, whilst the workshop model is exactly the same, it has very different resonances. So this gap in expectations was sometimes exposed during workshop spaces when an individual's sense of the good or proper conduct was actually violated by another participant, or more problematically, by the group. So, for example, in my first workshop, it was a US facilitator. They were very keen on sort of shouting, singing, clapping, and getting people up to dance and break down some of these barriers. And then when people didn't respond to this, she started to say, you know, what's up with you guys? And, you know, you're British, you know, you stiff up the lip. And people said, you know, we just can't deal with this. We can't deal with this way of doing things. And so this becomes a problem then when this kind of interaction is so central to the workshop model. And so, I mean, this begins to expose some of these tensions then that emerge in different cultural contexts. So similarly, there's been some work done on the role of silence as well. So in some European contexts, the role of silence and deep listening is very important, where in the UK, silence following a very difficult or emotional story was very difficult for a lot of people to handle because they felt that silence demonstrated a lack of interest, and so would often fill it with things like, I know exactly how you feel. And this would then cause arguments within the actual group, and so obviously wasn't effective in dealing with conflict. So to wrap up then, and what I should say is that whilst a lot of my work is drawing on the stuff from the work from policy mobilities, this is actually kind of at the boundaries, because I'm not necessarily talking about policy as such, but the mobilisation of a social programme and training model. But on the surface, what we have is an account of two US programmes of community intervention that really aspire to less violent, less discriminatory and less prejudiced cities through the replication of intervention models across an international network of cities. Now, in this regard, cities become the sites of replication and the mobilisation of community and leadership. Yet by paying closer attention to what actually happens on the ground, we can also see how local city contexts and participants actually remake this programme from the ground up, or how the organisation in question might actually facilitate more socially progressive politics at the local level. Now, of course, by paying closer attention to what actually happens on the ground, we can also begin to ask what happens when these programmes fail, or when there is disconnect between the organisation's aspirations and actions, and then the aspirations and actions of the participants involved. So I'm hoping that by bringing together the insights from policy mobilities together with work on communication studies, that this work can go some way to addressing that kind of disconnect.